Our next speaker is Dr. Schimmel Shaw. He is the head of the transplant program at the University of Cincinnati. He's going to talk to us now about current management of HCC. Schimmel.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Chapman, Dr. Maynard, for having me here today. I have no financial disclosures. So when we talk about the malignant mass and HCC, it's important that right away we understand our perspective. First of all, we need to take a good history, understand what the risk factors are for malignancy, where do they come from, a good physical exam, understanding their cirrhosis or lack thereof. Have they had any cancer screening? Could this be metastasis even though it looks like HCC? What do the labs look like? The imaging features, which I'll touch on. And then go from there. And I think as we understand what's happening in our world and in this part of the hemisphere, we have some changing modalities in terms of etiologies for liver transplantation and for HCC in general. Hepatitis B has been going down. Hepatitis C is also going down. We're seeing more and more alcoholic liver disease and fatty liver disease. And fatty liver disease, or NASH, is the triumvirate of having obesity, diabetes, and essentially is becoming something that is rising more and more and actually becoming the leading cause of HCC, at least in this country. HCC is a global problem around the world, and especially where you see the red circles there in Africa and parts of Asia. Not as much in North America, but it is growing rapidly here as well. And a lot of this is related to the rates of cirrhosis around the world, which correlates very much with the rates of HCC. And the liver cancer death rate also shown here, which correlates with the incidence, but especially in indigent populations around the world. So hepatocellular carcinoma most commonly will be asymptomatic, found incidentally, especially on screening. Sometimes can present with abdominal pain, although it's rare. Same thing with weight loss. And usually if you have symptoms, you need to worry about rupture, and that can present as an acute abdomen if that does happen. How do we make the diagnosis? Well, on ultrasound, you have essentially a target lesion on ultrasound. It's hypoechoic, and sometimes it has a center that's hypermetabolic. More commonly, we see this on the CT scan. On the arterial phase, we have hyperenhancement of the lesion, and on the portal venous phase, we have venous washout. And that's commonly what we see. Usually, if you have these findings, you don't need a biopsy of the lesion. Just another example, a hypervascular lesion here on the arterial phase, it's hyperintense, and then becomes hypointense on the portal venous phase. And then we like to get a triphasic scan where we have a delayed portal phase, as you see on the rightmost area here, where it remains hypointense and it also develops a pseudocapsule. What else do? Well, we look at the labs, and the alpha-fetoprotein is elevated in more than half of the patients in the United States, in the western part of the world. If you have the availability in your hospital, you can check the AFPL3, which is a little bit more specific. We don't do that at my place. A liver biopsy should be done if we don't have an accurate radiologic and a laboratory diagnosis, not necessarily needed. Tough to get a biopsy if the lesion is less than a centimeter, and then we can classify them as nodular, infiltrative, or diffuse. We did a study many years ago looking at the utilization of therapy for HCC in the Medicare population, and surprisingly found that although it's a common cancer, it's becoming more and more common, treatment was only offered in 30% of the patients, and 70% actually did not undergo treatment. And the surprising thing was that 43% of the patients actually were treatable or curable with early stage disease. So we have a problem in the country in the sense that we're not making the diagnosis early enough, and if patients have the diagnosis, they don't have access. And part of this is the whole algorithm is very complicated. Here's one example of a treatment algorithm for HCC. Here's one that we've tried to institute, and it's complicated, difficult to decipher, and requires a lot of practitioners. So essentially needs a formalized multidisciplinary program so that all different aspects of therapy can be thought about, discussed, and ultimately utilized. Who you see matters. Here's an example of a cirrhotic liver. There's ascites around the liver. The liver's shrunken down. But there are times where, depending on where you go, what type of surgeon or medical professional you see, and where you are, whether you're in the U.S. or in the world, your treatment is going to vary significantly based on those three factors. This gentleman, for instance, like Dr. Maynard described, ruptured umbilical hernia, massive ascites, muscle wasting. In all likelihood, there's really only going to be one therapy for this man, and that's a transplant. So let's talk about our different options and try to go through them quickly. This is a just kind of goes over the complexities. We start with liver transplantation. We have resection as an offering, ablation, TACE, or also Y90. Sorafenib is a chemotherapy. We could also do systemic chemotherapy. SBRT is increasing. And then there's the important thing that maybe we don't utilize enough, but do nothing. So I think the treatment options, liver resection, transplantation, and ablation tend to be more of what we think of as curative and palliative, sometimes chemoembolization, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. To be honest with you, this slide, actually, probably everything can be under curative now. And data is amounting for all different modalities and having their uses in different patients. So how about resection? So we estimate about 10 to 30% of patients are candidates for resection. Who's a candidate for resection? Well, first of all, you can't be a candidate for liver transplant. You're too old, maybe the patient doesn't want it, they're actively drinking. But the big one is usually you don't have any liver disease or you have fibrosis and you don't have overt cirrhosis. 10% of cancers in the US occur in normal livers, so you have to be on the watch out for that. We also have a referral bias. If you see a person who is going to be an advocate for resection and not as kind to other modalities, well, then you're going to end up having a resection. What are the reasons why resection won't work? Well, sometimes multifocal lesions, or the big one is going to be poor liver reserve. The problem with resection is we have major issues, especially in operating on the cirrhotic liver, which is what this symposium is about. We have our issues with inadequate functional reserve. We don't have good regeneration when you're operating on the cirrhotic, and the normalization of liver function is slow, sometimes can be up to 3 months to 6 months of patients recovering from major liver resections in the setting of cirrhosis. If they have portal hypertension, you're going to have massive hemorrhage, but more importantly, you're going to have liver dysfunction, liver failure, and long-term complications that would essentially result in death if transplantation is not offered as a salvage. So that's the big issue with liver resection. The results are good. There's many results. So this slide shows the results of resection from the 1990s. Obviously, there's many. But if you look to the box, you can see that in general, the recurrence rate's roughly around 50% when you resect. That should be, the patient should be alerted of that. And numerous studies have shown that essentially 50% is the norm. This is a more recent study from just a few years ago, looking at what happens. And so you have 774 patients that underwent curative liver resection for early stage tumors. Median size is small, 2.5 centimeters. Half were cirrhotic. And I think the important thing with this paper was that the recurrence rate is actually pretty equal whether the patient has cirrhosis or doesn't have cirrhosis. Many folks believe that the recurrence is much higher in this setting and the milieu of cirrhosis. I'm not sure that's actually true. Here's another paper published just recently as well, 130 patients with a good follow-up, and the recurrence rate also was 41.5% regardless of the margins, because the recurrences are occurring in the remaining liver, not necessarily at the margin. This is a study from the Far East showing that the recurrences are actually more aggressive after you resect. And so the thought about doing transplantation as a salvage after resection may be faulty thinking, because many of the recurrences are outside of Milan criteria, and so you can't salvage them with a transplant. So an important consideration when counseling the patient about resection. So why do we think about liver transplant? Well, there's many advantages. Usually cirrhosis is the underlying condition, as I mentioned, in 90% of the patients. Tumors are commonly multifocal. Remember, this is the tumor you see, and also the two or three tumors that you don't see yet that will come in the coming years. Usually the tumors are unresectable because of cirrhosis, the inadequate liver remnant, the recurrence rate with resection, as I talked about, and a solitary lesion in a compensated cirrhotic. You could argue that the liver transplant is probably the potentially the best cancer operation not withholding the lack of organs, but otherwise as a cancer operation, probably has the best results. The main reason it has the best results is that we have the best local regional clearance. Essentially in this picture, the liver is out, the whole liver is out, and that's why you have the good clearance and a new liver is about to go in. So patient selection is obviously the key with transplantation, and that's what we all live by. This is the landmark study from Mazzaferro that talked about the Milan criteria. And in that landmark paper, it was one tumor less than 5 centimeters and 3 less than 3 with excellent recurrence-free survival of 83% and a recurrence rate of only 8%. Most of us have matched that in our own series with these restrictive criteria. The UCSF criteria came out many years later, trying to expand it, and the results were similar and almost as good and most certainly acceptable with a 5-year survival of 75%. So what are the HCC, the indications for transplant for this cancer? It's growing, and actually now it's hard to know what isn't a candidate for transplant given our extent with downstaging in the last decade. And I think that really it's not a matter of size or number, it's now just becoming about the tumor biology and watchful waiting and seeing what happens when patients are placed on the list and what happens to the tumor, and that's the advantage that transplant has over resection is that we get to watch the biology. As I mentioned about resection prior to transplant, there's three terms that you'll hear. You have salvage transplant, selective transplant, where it's the initial therapy to see how the tumor does and then determine who benefits, and then the bridge to transplant. So I think whenever we talk about transplant, we need to understand the multimodal treatment about how to get patients to transplantation. We have many different tools in our toolbox. Number one, we have ablation. Ablation can be done percutaneously. It can be done laparoscopically. It could also be done open, although rarely done. And the results are very good overall, but the recurrence rate can be high over a long period of time. But as a bridge therapy is excellent. At our center, we use a Y90 primarily, a little bit of transarterial chemoembolization where we localize the tumors with arterial angiography and embolize the tumors and have had excellent results with that. More recently, techniques like SBRT are becoming more popular, potentially using it with photons. And what the advantage of SBRT is that you have better localization of the tumor and a better intensive tumor kill with the radiation compared to standard radiation therapy. The proton is something that we are starting to utilize, and this shows you an example of classic beam therapy where a lot of the radiation exposure doesn't even hit the spine or the tumor in this area, and it can focus on actually getting to the mass, and that's the benefit of a proton. Here's another example, being able to isolate in a cirrhotic liver where there's other structures right in the neighborhood and really focus on your tumor kill right at the mass. And it's actually not that new. It might be new to people in the room, but the studies have been going on for over a decade now. 1,580 patients in this meta-analysis from the Toronto group, and basically showing the results are actually quite good with protons. So when we think about how to figure out how to get people to transplant, we start with our selection, look at their tumor burden, their size. If they are within criteria, we go to liver transplant. If they're in expanded criteria, we think about local regional therapy, downstage them, and get them to where we need to get them. It's a multimodal therapy, and it's important that it works together as a theme. Here is the results of downstaging of numerous studies from around the world, primarily from the UCSF group, but from around the world, showing excellent results and how many actually make it successfully with downstaging with good level of evidence. In our own group, we just recently looked at our data, and actually were able to successfully downstage 21 folks out of about 90 that were eventually transplanted, and our results actually showed that they were similar to patients that started out within the Milan criteria. And many of these tumors were aggressive tumors, 5 to 10 centimeters in size, a couple with portal vein invasion as well. When we look at meta-analysis of resection versus transplant, I think we see that there is a benefit to transplantation over resection. These are all the studies that have been put out recently comparing resection and transplant. It's a busy slide, but you can see there's a lot of data out there. You need a intention to treat to fully understand the benefits of transplant and resection. And in this intention to treat analysis, we see that overall the summary is leaning towards transplantation. Here's another intention to treat analysis that was done that favored transplantation from the numerous studies that are in the literature. So finally, what about small early HCCs? We tend to focus on downstaging so much in our world. And where should we go with this? Well, this is a recent paper that showed that in tumors less than 2 centimeters, if you do resection, you do RFA, you got a good follow-up, what happens? Well, you have a high recurrence rate, 40% after resection, 63% after RFA. So these are important numbers for counseling. You can get them by in the initial time period, but in a short, less than 4 years, you do have high recurrence rates. But in that, in another study, 114 patients, small tumors, similar number underwent resection and transplantation. The survival, recurrence-free survival, was excellent with liver transplantation, pretty poor with resection at 32%. So I think the small tumors as well, something to consider. Obviously, the amount of cirrhosis is important. So the role of liver transplantation, the benefits are in survival, low recurrence, and you get the advantage of also treating their cirrhosis at the same time. We have limited availability of organs. We do have to wait, but I would argue that waiting is actually not a bad thing, and the patients are subjected to immunosuppression for the rest of their life, which could be an issue. So in summary, we have HCC is increasing around the world. It's increasing in the Western part of the world as well, and we need to understand what is the best treatment for this tumor, and I think for certain tumors, it's pretty clear cut that resection has a role, but has a high recurrence rate and should be used judiciously, but can be very effective. We need to work in a multidisciplinary fashion at our centers. We need to create protocols, have ongoing tumor boards, and as I like to preach, there needs to be a role for everyone. So whether it's the interventional radiologist doing Y90, doing TACE, your radiation oncologist doing SBRT, maybe one of your other surgeons or your IR folks doing ablation, your oncologist doing sorafenib, there is a role for everyone to get patients to the transplant, which potentially is the last option for a tumor like this. There's no doubt that transplant is the best and only therapy, and I think getting patients there requires a whole team. Thank you very much.